Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So today's episode, I have a piece called La Magerie Opera, which is part of the competition at Venice Immersive 2025. So this piece is a bit of a location-based entertainment type of installation experience using virtual reality. And so it's a co-production between Backlight, which has done a number of different LBE experiences before, as well as with the Paris Opera and Vive Arts as well. And so they're basically celebrating the 150th anniversary of the opera house of the Palais Garnier in Paris. And so you basically take this journey back behind the scenes, into the underwater, into all these kind of imaginal, spectacular worlds to kind of like see both the scenes playing out, but also eventually you see the actual opera house and then you go on this whole journey and then you see the opera play out within all these different contexts. And so you're kind of taking on this spatial journey and you're guided through this whole journey. So the contexts are, it's opera singing, but within the context of a long distance journey, adventure, as you explore lots of different spatial contexts from the surreal ocean bottom to the mundane virtual castles and all in and around the actual recreation of this world and starting there and ending there as well. So lots of different elemental balances. The first and primary center of gravity of this piece is the earth element in terms of like taking on a spatial journey. You also embodied as a character, I guess more of a figure that's being guided through this. And so you do have a bit of virtual avatar representation because you are there with other people. It's like a group experience as you're going through this. But more than anything else, you're getting a journey, a spatial journey through all these different worlds. And the key thing is that there's no edits, there's no cuts, there's no fades to black. It's basically a one shot, a oneer, where you're basically walking through all these different spatial contexts, and they manage to do that without breaking the continuity of feeling like you're just taking this epic long distance journey of just walking. So it's one of those magical components of virtual reality that I first experienced back with The Void back in like 2016 when I first saw it. So it's got this real magical quality, able to kind of transport you into feeling like you're in this kind of infinite walking. And Backlight, that's kind of like their bread and butter of being able to do that with these different experiences. So you're essentially going from like behind the scenes and seeing underwater, all these kind of exotic places. And in each of these, you're kind of seeing different scenes play out with singing that's happening, but also these character dynamics that are happening as well. So the second center of gravity is the water element, the timing of that, but also the music that's playing throughout is such a key part of this whole experience of like very much a kind of musical journey that you're going on. So there's a bit of a rhythm in the pace of the music as you're going through each of these scenes that they're playing out. And it's all about moving bodies through space in order to get to the next song and theatrically staging and acting through all these. But it's basically the music number. And by the end of it, it feels like it's quite an awe-inspiring type of journey that you've been taken on. But you could sort of think about it as you're moving your body through space, and that kind of movement through your body through space ends up being a bit of spatial editing as you go from one scene to the next. And so it's a bit of from one sequential room to the next in order to get an overall sense of the journey that's happening. And then the third center of gravity is the air element, the mental and social presence. There is a shared experience of you being with other people there. It's not just you alone, but you are there. But it's also a bit of a responsibility in terms of like, you could decide to clip through a wall and break the plausibility presence for other people, which, you know, happened during my experience. And so there's a bit of a shared social contract to go through this experience in a way that maintains your own integrity of plausibility, but also not acting in a way that may be breaking other people's plausibility. And I don't remember if there's any specific dialogue between these different characters. It may have just been songs throughout the entirety of the piece. I'm having a little bit of trouble remembering now that it's about a year ago. And then finally, the fire element is the last center of gravity. And that there isn't necessarily any narrative agency, but there is a bit of freedom for you to move your body within a space within bounds, because you can't move infinitely, but you can, very similar like as if you were going through a guided tour, you could decide if you want to be in the front, kind of positioning, and there's a bit of jockeying to see different scenes as they're playing out. Not that there's going to be like a better point of view or not, but you just are kind of walking through and you're seeing the scenes unfold around you, and you have a little bit of control as you're moving your body through space, but it's very limited and constrained. So it's kind of like the last center of gravity. So some of the different archetypal themes and character is that it's, quote, exploration of the ties between doubt, memory, and the stage. So yeah, those are the themes that they're covering within the piece. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Jonathan happened on Friday, August 29th, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Okay, so my name is Jonathan Astruc, so I'm the director of Backlight. Backlight was founded in 2008. We started as a 3D animation studio and VFX. and we're all kind of movie and video game geeks, of course. So when VR came in 2013, we took the DK1 and we all freaked out on it. And we, I don't know if you remember, but there was a site called Oculus Share, I think. And everybody we know was putting prototypes of VR. So we said, why not? So we made one. And we were, second or maybe first for at least 3 weeks. And we had like YouTubers all around the world commenting on our experience. And we were all surprised. And we said, okay, so maybe since we were a small studio and you have big studios in France that was doing all the same, it was a big competition. But VR was kind of a fresh field. And so we put our foot in the door and say, okay, so maybe this could be it.
Great. Maybe give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into working with VR.
Yes. Well, like I said, well, when I was young, my favorite movies were Tron, The Matrix, and the co-founders too. So I always, you know, liked new technologies. To tell you, I took a prototype where you could put like a circle on your head and would take your impulsions from your muscles and you could bind it to video games to control it almost with your mind. So I was always like new technologies. And for me, video games, I really wanted to see VR come, even when I was only a teenager, and see how the video games could use it. And it's funny because video games now are not, they kind of reject a little bit VR, and it's not the path I was expecting for it. And now it's the cultural path that I took this embrace to VR, so yeah, you cannot predict the future.
Yeah, maybe you could elaborate a little bit around like what's happened since the Oculus Share days of what kind of projects you've been working on there at Backlight.
Yes, so we started with a simple ride. So it was in a cartoon world. You had to chase a kind of a mythical bird. You know, it was a DK1, so it was only a 3DOF. You couldn't move your head in the space. So you had all this motion sickness coming in. And after we took the DK2, now you had 6DOF, and after we had this vibrating plate that we just, you know, screwed on the chair to give the impression of a vibration and take off a little bit of this motion sickness. And so naturally, we shared this experience a little bit, and we saw that a lot of people liked it. So we adapted to a D-Box, this moving dynamic chair. And this is how we got into the VR world with these rides. And after this, there's an escape game company that contacted us because they liked what we did and the graphic fidelity with our background into 3D animation and VFX. We can feel it in the way we are doing VR. And so they proposed us to do an escape game. So it was, I think, the first in the world escape game in VR where you had full body awareness. Since we like technology, we put some trackers on the wrist, the ankles, and the body. So you almost had full motion capture. Well, not as good as motion capture, but I think it was the first full body awareness in the world. And that's why, you know, we work with Blancali on the Bal de Paris. When we were, Michel curated us into Venice Festival, almost only for this feature, because, you know, Venice Festival doesn't put games in it. It's supposed to be art. But when he saw the quality of the full body awareness and how people in a shared environment, we could see others' animation, you could almost, because you were in spacesuit, you could recognize your partners only with the movement, since it was so accurate. So that's how we grown into the VR world.
I think I played both of those experiences. What were the names of those two experiences then?
It was Eclipse and Ascenders. And this is where we paved the way of our way to do VR, is what we called the plane shifting. This is how we construct the world around the players. For instance, Eclipse was in a spaceship, so you had a shuttle and elevators. But the people are only moving into a 5x4 meter square room, very little room, but we give them the illusion they are moving hundreds of meters with this. So we use, again, vibrating floors to give this illusion. So this is how Backlight tailored his way, and this is how we do VR. So now you can feel it in our experience. I think you maybe felt it in La Magie Opera, is how I like this image of a mouse moving into a maze, and we are constructing and changing the levels and make you turn into the same space, but give you the illusion that you are moving and have this seamless experience without cuts, any fade to black and all this. We really want you to think it was only one take.
Yeah, with the Eclipse, I think I saw at SIGGRAPH when it was showing at SIGGRAPH a number of years ago. And yeah, having like a four-person co-op with one other person, but then other people remotely, and having a lot of communication and puzzles to solve between the two. And then Ascenders, this experience of taking this spatial journey up a mountain, and again, yeah, having full body tracking and then able to create this whole spatial journey through this mountain and all these kind of rock characters. So then taking a lot of those lessons into this piece that's showing here at Venice this year, yeah, there is this sense of having a room that's a fair size. I don't know what the exact, yeah, the 8 by 8 meters, but you're able to really make a lot of use out of that space and create the sense of taking us on a whole journey. And so maybe you could take a step back of just describing how this project came about, because it seemed like it was maybe a collaboration with Opera House and then also Vive Arts. And yeah, just give a little bit more context for the catalyst for how this project came about.
Yeah, of course. Well, we knew Opera for a bit. There were some projects they were interested, like for the Universal Exposition at Osaka. We almost worked together, but it didn't work like we wanted, for a lot of reasons. And after we really knew we wanted to work with Opera, so we went back to them because they'd never done VR before. And we knew that they were interested in a project. So we developed for a year only a discussion, concept, contracts, trying to find sponsors. We had the first draft. But by the end of 2024, the sponsors we didn't get the finance we needed to do it. We had a whole script where you would visit other parts of the opera. So it was a big project, a very pricey project. So when we knew the sponsors couldn't get on this work, we decided to self-finance the project and come to the opera and say, okay, it's December, you have the anniversary of Opéra Garnier. It's in May. We really want to do the project. So we had to strip off some part of the script, go very, very fast. I think it's one of the most fast-paced experiences we've ever made. And that's why the opera, of course, was focused on all the music aspects. Of course, it's their job. But they really had a lot of confidence in our work for all the other aspects, the graphic fidelity and what I was saying, the plane shifting, how you move the people, and the immersion. That was really important. So this is why we had almost carte blanche, like we say, with them. And of course, they were giving us all their music library. They had this annual program, and we could choose in it some parts and create a narrative thread to bind all these areas together.
And so because you were self-financing it, did you have like a distribution plan in place? Did it have a date that it was going to launch? Were you working in collaboration with the Opera House? Maybe just describe what the plans are to have it like as a location-based entertainment experience.
Well, yeah, the Opéra Garnier, they gave us a space they have, a very nice space near the big stairs, you know, you see. And normally, this is why they do a little museum. You can see dresses and props from famous opera. And they say, okay, you can take this space, the carousel of opera. So this was the world premiere over there. And we did all the operations. So we had to hire the people over there and set up, because, you know, we're streaming, so we have routers, so we have to we really invest their space and transform it to make it work over there.
Yeah, and watching the artist statement video that you had submitted to Venice, just to see the fidelity of this opera house in the context where it was being shown, maybe you could just give a bit more context for making this translation between featuring aspects of this opera house that you were collaborating with and bringing parts of that physical location into VR, but also the story that you're telling and like how you settled upon the story that you're going to tell, as well as the different locations that you were going to take the viewers on.
Yeah, well, for the story, we knew Opera was really interested in VR because, you know, it dusts off a little bit of what people think about the opera, like it's for more aristocratic people, and you know, they want to bring another population into the opera. So this is why we wanted to have a lyrical singer that is a black woman, because otherwise people would think it's for maybe, it's very whitey, I'd say. So this was very important. And to have this young aspect, this is the challenge. So we had to keep the heritage of the opera, the legacy of the opera, without keeping it not transformed too much what it meant, but we had to have this modern take on the opera, so to make it a little bit fresh. And this is why we created the character of Celeste with someone who, when I made the character sheet and how she was somebody very normal who likes chocolate and listen to music. So we wanted to make her feel being a singer in the opera is just another person, like a normal person. And having doubts was really important, to make this connection with the public and still showcase these wonderful arias from the opera. So this was the challenge we strive for, to tailor this experience.
Yeah, and you really make the most use out of this 8x8 space, because you're snaking around and walking around, and then in VR you're able to create these impossible spaces where, they would kind of fold up on top of each other. And so just curious how you start to map out some of these different spaces. Like, what are your techniques if you use a blueprint, or if you kind of have multi-layers because it's kind of folding on top of each other, or if you're just jumping into Unity and gray boxing it, or if you actually have a plan for the pathing that you're going to take people through as you are walking through this experience?
Yeah, it's at Backlight we iterate a lot. So we start here with Celeste was just a big cylinder at first. After, it was just a mannequin, that was moving without... the mannequin was moving, but no animation on it. So we started with the big stairs you see at the beginning. We know we have this 8x8. And so after, we go into a big brainstorming where we draw plans, plans from above. And we say, okay, if the people go over there, we make it down here. And after we have to find some ways, you go out of this room, we put you in an alley and we make you go back in this alley, but we changed the levels at this point. So we give you the illusion that you're moving into a big space, but you're really turning around. And this is the first part, this is the really first step of our project. And after, the graphic assets are coming after and going on this wireframe. This is really important to see. Since we know we only work between 20 and 30 minutes, we really have to settle everything at the beginning, and after we will work on the graphics and all this. So this is really the first steps.
Yeah, maybe you could describe a little bit around the multiple operas and the characters you're going to feature in this piece.
Oh yeah, so when we started the script, I knew I had a friend, Karen Hunt, who worked in video games before, and narration and empowerment for women. So we really wanted her to create, to give the story to Celeste. And as a matter of fact, when I called her, she told me, hey, since 2 years, I'm a big fan of opera. So I said, oh, perfect. That's perfect. So we created with Eric Barbador, who is a writer at Backlight, we created. So she picked the arias, because we wanted to, like I said, to have this girl who went, Celeste, who went on this journey of self-doubt and going to be someone with confidence at the end. And so she proposed that we started with Rusalka. So Rusalka is the Little Mermaid from Andersen. And that was Dvorak Tolkien, inspired by this, did Rusalka. So this is, we really started, in the young part of Celeste, the first contact she had with the opera. And after we moved to Tosca, Tosca is more of the rebellion. So it was, like we said, it's the teenage phase. And after we finished with Carmen, who is the real empowerment, she doesn't care about what we say about her. She just does it. So it was a perfect evolution. It wasn't just random arias like this. There was a natural narrative thread combining these three arias.
And those three areas, are those all from three existing operas that were all kind of mashed together?
Well, no, they were separated, but the opera gave us the annual program, so we could really pick in it, and they would say they were okay with it. So this is how we say, okay, this one, and this one, okay, it's perfect to create this evolution into the character.
Okay. So one character kind of threading together these three separate operas throughout the course of the story. So we start off in a opera space, and then we very soon go into being underwater and kind of walking around, taking a little journey, sneaking around these kelp paths, but also, you know, having a song and then having all these jellyfish is quite a spectacle that you're able to create. And so just talk a bit about this process of being able to take people underwater within this first act of this piece.
Well, yeah, I really wanted to have this part where you start into a real environment and have this mix between reality, dream, reality, dream. This was the first project, the first part of the project where we had a high budget. So you would be in the big stairs, have this part in a dream. After you were in the lake under the opera, and after you were into the, not the backstage, but under the scene, where you have, it's called cabestan, it's the rope you can pull to, you know, to make the, how do you say, the set, all the set, the background come in onto the scene. So we have this mix, so reality, dream, reality, dream, reality, dream. So when we had to strip off a lot of elements from this scenario to fit into the new budget, you can see there's still some, inspiration from this other script. So this is why now you have the big stairs and you go into the dream, because like I said at Backlight, we don't like teleportation, we don't like fading to black, so everything needs to be seamless. So this is how we can transport you from a real place to a fantasy place. So this is why you have this transition going underwater. She takes the partition from Rusalka, and just taking his partition makes her go back into her memories and all this, and you go with her. So this is the way we found to have this seamless transition between two environments.
Yeah, I guess there's no cuts in this piece, are there?
Yeah, that's it. So it's funny because it's very straining on the teams, the developers and, you know, the guys, 3D artists and all this. And every time they say, oh, no, we have to do it seamless again, because it can be very tricky to put two pieces together. But we say, yeah, but we're going to support you, but this is how we do VR. So maybe you don't see it, but it's a lot of work to do all this seamless thing. And I think we are, Backlight is one of the solution we take. Other companies try to do teleportation or fading to black, but we say, no, this is our way to do VR. And this is how we are well known for.
Yeah, it takes me back to when I saw the first demo of The Void when I went to Utah, and they had like a redirected walking type of thing where you were kind of walking in circles, but it felt like you were walking in pretty much a straight line. And yeah, it's just like this sense of like endless walking and adventuring. And I feel like you're able to really tap into that type of deep sense of embodied and environmental presence as you're taking us through these different worlds without ever breaking the continuity of that. So it definitely creates this deep sense of immersion in that way. And because you are sneaking around, are you using any redirected walking techniques, or is it mostly just being able to kind of fold the virtual spaces on top of each other so that you could just give this seamless quality of never breaking the illusion of being in this single location that goes on and on and on?
No, yeah, it's very simple. We don't use redirecting techniques. It's old techniques, but we, since, like I told you, Eclipse with only a vertical movement and a horizontal, we iterate on this. And now in Magie Opéra, now there are turns, there are diagonals, and so we iterate a lot. And what we did, like in Blancali, Le Bal de Paris, at one time you're in a vegetal maze, how do you say, with plants, you know, a maze.
So like a corn maze?
Yeah, well, corn maze. And you can see really how we take off pieces of the levels and put it in front of the people, and they never see what we do. So it's very simple, but it's very precise. And this is how we iterate on the simple things we were doing at almost 10 years ago. And you can see now into the Magie Opéra. So we stay simple, but we kind of, perfectioned it. And we still have ideas, you know, to push the thing further. And what time we did another piece that was called Toyland, was a shooter, where you had vibrating floors and dynamic chair combined together. So it's kind of expensive setup, but we really take what we have what's the concept, what's the technology, and after, and we tailor our experience and do what I call the plane shifting. Like I said, it's really most of the work we are doing.
Yeah, and maybe you could speak a little bit around the avatars and avatar design, because you have what feels like you're in this Victorian era ball, or I don't know how you describe the characters and the dress that they have, but it seems to be in alignment with some of the other characters that are appearing in the opera later, so that there seems to be like more of a seamless blurring between the motion captured actors versus the other audience members. So you get the sense of everybody being a same part of the community. But just curious to hear you explain a little bit around the character design of these different avatars.
Well, yeah, it's funny because when we start a project, the first question we ask, because we do a lot of multiplayer and shared environments, so we don't really like just having, bland avatars just to avoid people bumping into each other, because I think it's not very immersive. It will take you off from the environment you're in. So the first question we ask when we start a project is, who are we and what are we doing here? So this is why in Magie Opéra, they are all dressed and they are from the chorus, the choir. So we have to have a woman, a man, different skin colors. And for this part, we went into what Opéra Garnier had done before. So that's why the dress is from the previous piece they've done. And to have this, and they convey this feeling of opera that a lot of people, imagine of what they would see at the opera. So this is why we start off as these avatars, and when we finish the experience, we see we are part of this. So this is another point we really want to make about what are you doing here and what why are you here. That's it.
Yeah, and there's some really great motion capture and acting that's throughout this as well. Maybe you could just describe a little bit around the process of doing the character capture within this piece.
Yes, so since we did, I told you, it was a tight budget and a fast-paced experience. Like, the mocap studio had this date they could shoot for us, and it was like 1 week and a half, and we still didn't have the actress, so we had to make a casting, the quickest casting I've ever made in my life, and we found the perfect one among talented other actors, because we saw that she really could move, because she's also doing the capture of all the other singers, like Rusalka, Tosca, the first two singers, and it's cool because we don't have a lot of budget, but we like the idea too that she was doing Celeste and doing the movement of the singers that we are seeing. So we only could mocap her and the partner she has in the Baron Scarpia, who gets stabbed in Tosca. But at Backlight, we have something called AR-51. So it's an in-house mocap solution that uses cameras, but you don't need, a vest motion capture suit. It only it's using AI. So you're just like this. It films you and it gives you a little motion capture. So the people you see at the end on Carmen is me and another Lisa. Lisa, who is doing the mocap, and we duplicated ourselves, to complete all the sets. So we have this flexible solution and using a different method. But we knew that for Carmen, we needed a really good motion capture for this.
Yeah, I really appreciated the fluidity of the movements and moving around. The one thing that I did notice, though, when it comes to the singing, was that because it is opera, it felt like a lot of the animation was just in the face, but not like of the breathing of the body, of like either the chest or the stomach, which I would expect to see when someone's singing opera. And so just kind of my own memory of singing opera singers, it's sort of like a full body performance, and then it kind of gets collapsed in the face. When I was watching it, it felt a little uncanny in the sense of like, okay, it's reminding me that I'm not watching somebody actually sing, but there's other limitations for how much fidelity you can really add to these other body parts to give this full body performance. So I'm not sure if that was a budget thing or if you had explored and trying to figure out how to convincingly depict somebody in VR singing opera.
Yeah, well, like you said, it was with the delay and the budgets, because it wasn't performance capture. So we had the motion capture, and after we used the, with Unreal Engine, we can use, the iPad to do the facial animation. And this was a lot of work, so we had to prioritize all this. So first the motion capture, after the facial capture, And we really wanted to have this dress, so we have this dynamic clothing that Celeste have. It was a lot of work. And after we had the performance of production, after we didn't have anything. And so we didn't have really time to come back and to give our thing, but it was into the list, but it didn't make it. That's it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so it sounds like that this is a piece that actually did premiere and have a chance to show to the general audience and public. And just curious to hear some of the reactions of what were some of the reactions of people seeing it, and how was the Opera House, like, were they happy with the results, and if they want to continue to go down this path of doing these different types of pieces?
Well, yeah, I think they really loved it, because they, when we had something to, after, you know, Celeste being just a cylinder or just a body moving without animation, we showed what we did to the opera, so the president and the vice president of the opera, and they were very pleased of what they saw, because, like I said, it was the first VR experience. They've never done VR before, so I was kind of anxious to see how the opera, a house that is so precise on thing, and how they would feel about it. And they were, I think, really impressed with what we've done. And for the public, I think that we had very, very good reaction. People who didn't do VR before, people who did VR before. So again, for this 4 months of production, I think we really put our knowledge of VR in it. And I think we were rewarded with great reactions.
Yeah, and I know that Vive Arts has been working with a lot of different cultural institutions to see how they could start to preserve different aspects of cultural heritage through these different types of virtual reality experiences. And so just curious to hear a little bit more around this collaboration with Vive Arts and the role they played in creating this project.
Oh yeah, they were really close to us, and they gave us some financial aid. Of course, I said we were self-financed, but we were aided by Vive Arts and the CNC. It's a French institution that gives money for who can help companies on creation. And yeah, Vive Arts, we're talking with Samantha King, is a fan of opera. We pitched the project and she was very interested in it. And she followed us and gave us some advice along the production. So they were really helpful for the project.
Yeah, in terms of the experience of walking through, each of the audience members did have a full body. And sometimes the body doesn't always perfectly line up to what you're doing. And if it loses hand tracking, then it can glitch out a little bit. But I think overall, it felt like I was mostly embodied in these characters. And there are some interactive components here. Like you have during the mermaid sequence, you have like all these glowing orb bubble type things that people can interact with. There's some scenes where you start to blast out into this kind of gravity-less reality where you're in a castle and you're able to kind of push objects around. And, you know, there's some times where the leader can like open up a door, but overall it's like pretty light interactions. And so just curious to hear a little bit around your thinking around trying to add different elements of interactivity to a piece like this.
There's a lot of discussion about this at the studio. So we feel that since we did Eclipse, where it was full interaction, but it was an escape game, but it's for an audience that knows, that likes escape game, these type of games. But for the opera, we have to open it to a large audience. So what we do is called light interaction. So it's not interaction that would block the narration. Because we need to have, you know, we have, when we operate, we have some slots. So we know the experience doesn't have to go further than 25 minutes. So this is why we have to find this type of light interactions that will never block 12 people together. So this is the really complicated part to do. I would have loved to do more interactions, but this is for the dev team. And so, again, such a fast-paced production, we had to do some light interaction, but I would have loved to do more. And to give them, maybe people can grab stuff and all this, but we had to do it very simple for this.
Yeah, one of the things that you have in your piece is this continuity of the space and as you're going through these different spaces. And there's a little bit of a collective agreement of the other audience members that they're not going to like clip through different walls or other stuff to kind of break the presence. And so I found myself a couple of times where there's a scene where you're overlooking, looking down on these actors playing out a scene, and we're overlooking from above, and there's this kind of really thick wall that I found myself even like I'm going to walk through this wall in order to get a better view. And then, but when I look over, then everybody's kind of clipped in the wall. And then as I'm sitting there watching it, the person next to me is just like, not only on the wall, but it's just like floating in the air because they decided that they wanted to get even a better view. I was like, oh, you're kind of killing the vibe here because you're breaking the illusion that we're in VR and that this isn't real. And so I'm sure there could be some things you try to force people to not do that type of stuff. But at the same time, in order to do that, then you would have to, if people are walking forward, then they would have like resistance that could make it uncomfortable experience for them. So just curious how you negotiate this kind of, you know, in wrestling, they call it kayfabe, which is like everybody's agreeing to suspend their disbelief on this illusion that we're all going to be watching. And then in VR, I was noticing it particularly in this experience because so much of it is maintaining the integrity of the space. But some people are kind of like, oh, peeking behind the wall, and like they're moving their body through these spaces in a way that kind of breaks the illusion in a way. So just curious to hear a little bit about how you start to negotiate the agency of the people versus trying to preserve the integrity of the sense of environmental presence.
Well, it was on the list, the famous list we have of stuff to do, the wall being much thicker. So like this, you wouldn't have this big wall where you can see the avatar's clips. And on the list, we have different avatar behavior, like contextual, where they are standing. So if they are in front of a big wall, we can force position where your legs would stay and wouldn't clip into the wall. So like I said, it was on the list, but they didn't make it. So yeah, when I see this, it's always a little bit, yeah, like you said, it breaks a little bit of the immersion on this part, but I think overall it plays well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's part of things that you can enforce with the technology, but it's also like if everybody's collectively trying to have an awareness of their actions, maybe like impacting other people's experiences if they're doing behaviors that are, you know, trying to push the edge or break VR or do things that, like, you know, there's somebody that was like looking behind the mirror and then like clipping through, and I don't know, there seems to be a certain element of a shared agreement of people that are going through experiences like this to not do that type of stuff because doing that could impact other people's experiences. And I feel like it's a bit of a fluency of like people may not even understand what they're doing, maybe impacting people in that way or kind of breaking the illusion. So I feel like it's also part of the audience's responsibility to not do that. So I feel like as audiences get more sophisticated, then there's a bit of this magic circle and shared agreement that people have, but we haven't necessarily formalized that in any way. So I don't know if that's another thing that you think around, like how to create the culture within the audiences to make sure that everyone's having the best experience that they can.
Yeah, it's funny you say this because we have, since it was, again, a quick production, we didn't have a lot of beta testing. And when you don't do a little beta testing and you put it, you see behavior you didn't expect. So, and the session are really different from a session from the other. You have people who are in it and will kind of respect what we try to do, and people who would just want to see the backstage and how it works. And it's funny to see, but if we had this feedback before, you could block the views, or maybe when you try to put your head into a zone that you're not supposed to see, we can use the fade to black even if we don't like it, but just to say, okay, now you're breaking the rules too much, so please stop. So this is, we see, it's funny to see all the behaviors that you see in people that you wouldn't expect. So this is, how would you say, very learning from things that, I wouldn't do the experience like this, and other people who just play along. So people are very different.
Yeah, and I noticed that you're using Vive headsets, standalone headsets. Maybe you could just speak a little bit around the VR hardware that you're using and also the software that you're using in order to manage that many people going through an experience like this.
Well, we always partnered with HTC because they provide us with a professional solution to have this location-based. First, we used the Lighthouse, and now it's the camera tracking and all this. So we partnered with us from almost the beginning. We know the material, we know the device, so this is why we're staying with them. And what was the
rest? Oh, yeah, if there's any other like software that you're using that's custom, or if it's just using the regular Unity and everything else that in order to manage the headsets and the shared experience of it all.
Yeah, we have some in-house software. We're using Unreal Engine, but we really have to break it a little bit to make our custom tools. Like we have a tool that will map the floor, and we can move if we have some discrepancies between the real walls and our virtual walls. We have an in-house tool to adjust everything, and we can rotate it and translate, make him translate all over. So yeah, we have our backlight generic tools that we use for all our experience. So the dev team know a little bit more on this, but I know when I have to go into the engine, we have like 5 plugins that we made, because we know we always do these location-based virtual projects. So every time we start, we iterate on these plugins that exist since almost, I think, 5 or 6 years. So we have our own tools tailored for our experience.
Can you speak a little bit more around the fiducial marker approach that you have? Because you have tape that creates these different shapes and patterns. And is that a pattern that the software is telling you to make? Or do you make the pattern and then teach the software, and that just helps it create other reference points in order to maintain the tracking? So just curious what that process is like, because it's, these rooms that have all these fiducial marker type tape. So yeah, just curious to hear about that process of how you do that.
Well, we saw that Vive has his own help page where they say, okay, how can you help the camera, the virtual headset, how to find this? So they gave us some general guidelines, and after we tried to tailor them to put some artistic thing to them. So you can see here in Venice, we have some 4 panels. I know if you've seen them, but they are part of a greater. We had the floor was done in this artistic thing, because so we ask the artist on it, okay, we need some big contrast, we need some intersections. So for here, we, with the co-founder, the author Jonathan of Backlight, and Frederic, who's the CTO, he knows what the headset needs, and after we just went with our artistic feeling and just put the tape like this, so I hope you liked it too.
Yeah, and so after you put it out, then it just kind of automatically detects it, and it just helps with the tracking.
Well, after Frédéric Plantard, the CTO, just comes in with his headset and he says, okay, or we need to put more tape, we need to help the headset to more have this feeling of the room. That's it.
Great. So what's next for Backlight?
Well, there's a lot of people coming in for this location-based type of stuff that we're doing. We really went from escape games to museum. So we still have some projects that are coming in. You will hear about it very soon. And we hope to iterate. We can tell you that now that we have this shared environment with plane shifting, I can tell you a little bit more on this other project. Now that we have a shared environment, but people are in a different time of day. So people would be like at noon, and the assets are in a particular place, and other people at night. But we switch the assets, but the obstacles are still the same. So you have the illusion that you are sharing this environment with other people, but they are in another time of day, and they think that you are in the same time of day. So, like I said, we iterate on this type of a way of thinking VR.
And when you've been mentioning plane shifting throughout the course of this interview, do you mean that you're able to create impossible spaces that fold on top of each other? Is that basically what you mean?
Yes, that's it. That is, like I say, you in Magie Opéra, you exit a room, you go into a little alley, and when you don't see the previous room, we take it off and put another level. So when you come back, it's a totally other space. So this is the base principle of plane shifting. We're hiding you the reality, changing it while you're not watching. And the whole. So a little magic trick we like to do. Like I said, like a mouse in a maze, you see it above and you can change the maze like you want, and the mouse wouldn't see anything.
And I know that Excurio has been having these big location-based entertainment experiences that similarly have a lot vaster space, where it can have up to like 100 to 150 people per hour go through some of these experiences. And I know that as they've been expanding out their distribution centers across North America and around the world, they're also looking for independent producers to help to produce content that would be distributed through this network. So this types of projects that you're working on seems to be in that same vein. I'm just curious if you've been exploring potentially creating projects that would be distributed by some of these different places at Excurio-based spaces around the world, or if you're much more interested in using your own homegrown system and distributing your own work.
Yeah, well, we have this Backlight is creating us immersive. So we want to make our brand a VR. We want to spread around the world. And it's funny because you say Excurio have this really big environment, and sometimes I would like to work on this kind of environment. But our solution is only since the size, all of our experience is in small-sized things. We can find more opportunities to distribute and sell those pieces. Like in opera, Excurio couldn't put all the size they have in it. So we had the space opera gave us. So we had the opportunity to do the experience for them.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you're being a lot more efficient in the space that you have and doing this kind of plane shifting and folding. So that makes sense because, yeah, you do need quite a lot of space and footprint for something like Excurio. So great. Well, finally, I guess as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think some of the ultimate potential of virtual reality and immersive storytelling might be and what it might be able to enable.
Well, I really like the fact, like I told you before, that I was kind of surprised that the video game industry is kind of a bit of rejecting VR. Sony is pushing a little bit. This was my kind of childhood dream to have this. Meta is pushing, but I see it doesn't have this, you know, spark of, okay, it's not an industry game changer. But when I see my mother, who is going to see the evolution from Excurio and the dinosaurs, she's asking me to go and see those VR projects. I'm saying, okay, so I was wrong on expectations. And I think for museums, like Excurio did the Impressionist for Musée d'Orsay. And I think like 80% or 90% of the people coming to see the paintings went to see the VR experience. And a very large audience, I would say seniors, kids. So this is where I think, and Backlight is going into this direction, to enhance the cultural aspect and the museum. And I think, VR has a really good place into cultural aspect.
Awesome. Is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Well, I'm so thrilled to come here into Venice and to see all the creators, what they are doing. Since we are working a lot, I don't have time to see what's going on. And so see all the creativity and have exhibitionists. I see it's limitless in terms of creativity. So here I come to get inspired by others.
Awesome. Well, Jonathan, really enjoyed the La Magie opera. Is that the magic opera? Is that what it translates to? Do you know?
Well, no, we kept the French with the E with the accent because, you know, we want to convey this French touch.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, really enjoyed the kind of spatial experience of this piece. You know, it's really striking to kind of walk endlessly in an experience where you're in a confined space, and it's a bit of a magic trick to feel like you just keep walking and walking and walking, and the way that you're able to take us through all these different scenes and tell a story is just really quite impressive as this kind of spatial experience. So, yeah, just really enjoyed the piece and enjoyed hearing a little bit more about your journey starting into early days of Oculus Share, into these location-based experiences, and now into working with cultural institutions with this plane-shifting approach that you're doing. It's really quite innovative. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals, and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.